Case number 19-1748, United States of America versus Sophia Eggleston. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Salinas, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Melissa Salinas, and I am the supervising attorney for Ms. Eggleston from the University of Michigan Law School. I appreciate you letting the student's attorneys present this case today, and I would like to introduce to you Sophia Gonzalez, who will present the first part of the argument, and Ms. Emma Ha, who will present the second part of the argument. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Sophia Gonzalez, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Sophia Eggleston. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I will discuss issues relating to the safe harbor defense, and my co-counsel, Emma Ha, will focus on restitution and sentencing enhancements. Now, the district court abused its discretion when it granted the government's motion in limine to exclude testimony from Ms. Eggleston's former patients. This evidence was relevant to Ms. Eggleston's safe harbor defense. Specifically, it related to whether she was providing covered services as a bona fide employee and to countering the government's theory at trial that Ms. Eggleston knowingly and willfully provided patients with unnecessary home health care services.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you so early in your argument, but is that a fair representation of what was decided in the motion in limine? There was a question of bringing in people and just demonstrating that they needed services and they got services. But the reference to the exclusion, it was clear that the judge said as it relates to safe harbor, this testimony may be admissible. Isn't that the way the record went?
Yes, Your Honor. What the court decided at the motion in limine hearing with regards to this evidence from former patients is that evidence that they qualified for, received, or were not paid to receive medically necessary service was outright irrelevant to the safe harbor defense, and therefore she could not present that evidence. But we're arguing here that evidence was in fact relevant. As part of the safe harbor provision, a defendant must show that they are both a bona fide employee within a bona fide employment relationship and providing covered items and services. And this testimony was relevant to show that Ms. Eggleston was providing covered items and services, those services which can be paid for by medical care that patients actually need in order to qualify for this provision.
But the problem I have with that is it tends to swallow the fact that it doesn't make any difference if every one of these people were in dire need of services and they got the services and everybody was happy, because that isn't the gravamen of the offense at all. It doesn't make any difference whether they needed the services or whether they got the services.
Your Honor, I would disagree. While it's not enough on its own to show that patients receive medically necessary services, the fact that she was working as a legitimate bona fide employee to provide these services goes to show that she was working within the scope of the safe harbor provision. And at trial, she did present other evidence relevant to the fact that she was working pursuant to a bona fide employment relationship, as relevant to the factors discussed in Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company v. Darden and as applied by the Fifth Circuit in United States v. Sanjar. For example, she testified to the fact that she was supposed to be paid hourly as relevant to the manner of payment. With regard to whether the work is part of the employer's regular business, she testified that she was informing seniors about their eligibility for these services from the home healthcare agencies. And as to employers' control over work hours, she testified that she submitted timesheets to the home healthcare agencies. So this testimony, what it did was it provided the necessary connection between the fact that she was a bona fide employee and providing covered items and services. And Your Honor, even if this wasn't necessarily relevant for purposes of the safe harbor provision, it was relevant to counter the government's theory in its case in chief, and Ms. Eggleston knowingly and willfully provided unnecessary medical services to these patients. At trial, that was their theory. Their theory was that she was fraudulently providing these services in force of patients. But to Ms. Eggleston's knowledge, she was actually helping very sick patients who needed these services to get them. And this testimony would have been relevant to show that she lacked the requisite intent under the anti-kickback statute and not the government's evidence on that point. And I would point to this circuit's case in decision in United States v. Danishvar. there, or it's similar to that case here, the government or the court took the government's evidence as conclusively establishing the fact that Ms. Eggleston knowingly and willfully provided these unnecessary services, and found any evidence to the contrary to be irrelevant. And that was an error because the jury should have been able to consider Ms. Eggleston's evidence along with the government's in making their conclusion as to this fact. Further, this ruling also invoked the concern in United States v. Equibellum, which is a Central District of California case. In that case, there was a concern about excluding evidence relevant to Safe Harbor that would also go to attack the government's case in chief or show a failure on the government's part to prove any of the elements. And that's exactly what happened here. This evidence was relevant to undermine the intent element of the anti-kickback statute. And in excluding this evidence, it ultimately limited what Ms. Eggleston could use to attack the government chief on this point. And I would also point to the Eastern District of Michigan's decision in United States v. Marlinga. In that case, it bears a lot of similarity to this one. The defendant was allowed to present evidence related to whether he had helped criminal defendants without any receipt of campaign contributions to specifically rebut the government's evidence in that case that he was helping criminal defendants in exchange for campaign contributions. And similarly here, that's exactly what Ms. Eggleston wanted to do with that evidence. And if your honors have no further questions, I would just ask that this court reverse and remand Ms. Eggleston's case for a new trial. And I will allow my co-counsel to speak with regards to restitution and sentencing enhancements.
Thank you.
Good morning, your honors, and may it please the court. My name is Emma Ha, and I also represent the appellant, Ms. Eggleston. Given the limited time today, I will first discuss issues pertaining to joint and several restitution. And time permitting, I will then discuss the erroneous application of the sentencing enhancement. First, it was plain error for the district court to impose joint and several restitution across multiple criminal defendants and cases. The error was clear and obvious because it misapplies section 3664H. As cited in our brief, our sister courts have found this provision to allow for joint and several restitution across multiple defendants only when the defendants are charged in a single case. This court in U.S. versus Hargrove held in 2013 that district court could not apportion restitution for the aggregate harm and impose joint and several restitution upon multiple criminal defendants where the defendants are charged in multiple cases. In the same case, this court noted that the 2nd, 7th, 8th, and the D.C. circuits agree with this interpretation. Disallowing joint and several restitution across multiple defendants and cases also makes practical sense for future cases. A bright line rule would promote an ease of administrability and consistency among the district courts. This error affected Ms. Eggleston's substantial rights because Ms. Eggleston is the prototypical defendant to have apportioned liability. In U.S. versus Bogart, this court in 2009 held that economic circumstances and the defendant's respective contribution to the victim's losses are relevant factors in determining whether liability should be apportioned among the defendants. And if the other defendants do not timely pay their portion of restitution, Ms. Eggleston could be responsible for a higher amount than would otherwise be if restitution had been apportioned. And not having a bright line rule here could also result in a windfall to the victims. And here the victim is Medicare, which means that Medicare could receive more than was taken. And with my remaining time, I will discuss why the sentencing court erred in applying the leadership role enhancement. This court reviews this question de novo because Ms. Eggleston objected to the enhancement in her sentencing memo. The nature of Ms. Eggleston's relevant conduct only related to the activities of the enterprise. Here, the volume of her work is not dispositive. This court in U.S. versus Turner held in 2013 that the relevant conduct in question for the leadership role enhancement is not where the defendant merely exercised control over the activities of the enterprise. The nature of Ms. Eggleston's relevant conduct does not relate to her leading or exerting control over the scheme or any other participant. Ms. Eggleston, in reality, was a low-level employee who did not even have access to the master spreadsheet that tracked all the recruiter's activities. Ms. Eggleston merely used her discretion within the scope of her role in the enterprise. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Amanda Jawad on behalf of the United States. Sophia Eggleston violated the anti-kickback statute because she received a payment for every patient that she recruited. She could not have established that she was a bona fide employee of the home health care agency. So that's where I'd like to begin. And that's the first issue, the safe harbor issue. The court did not preclude Ms. Eggleston from raising the safe harbor defense. The court was actually very careful in its ruling to note that it was not keeping her from presenting evidence related to the safe harbor. And in fact, Ms. Eggleston didn't even request a jury instruction on the safe harbor at the close of evidence. At no time did she request such an instruction. Issue should be reviewed for plain error. In terms of the other evidentiary ruling that the district court made connected to the safe harbor defense, that would be the district court's ruling precluding her from calling patients solely to testify that they received necessary services. And that's not relevant to whether or not she received kickback payment in her employment relationship with the entities from which she received those payments. So I'd like to move on to the restitution issue that was raised as well. And here, she can't establish plain error because she did not, she wasn't harmed by what happened. She hasn't satisfied the third prong, an effect on her substantial right. She actually was helped by the restitution order in this case. The appellant argues that she is somehow, by virtue of this being joint and several, going to be responsible for a larger amount. And that's just not what happened in the district court. The district court specifically apportioned the payments so that she was only responsible for paying restitution on the claims for which Medicare paid based on patients that she recruited. And if you look at the restitution amounts for the other co-defendants, those amounts are much larger. So she's not actually paying more money because her restitution is joint and several with other co-defendants. She's paying less because if they pay toward restitution, it could actually decrease the amount that she owes. So she can't show any prejudice or effect on her substantial rights, and thus there was no plain error in the restitution.
Counsel, would you go over that with me again?
Yes.
Because I thought I heard you say that, well, it's joint and several with these other people, and they might pay stuff that would really redound to her amount. Wouldn't the converse be true, that she conceivably could be liable for paying things that would be part of their restitution amounts?
No, Your Honor.
If the government sought to go after her, I don't see how it can't be reciprocal. That's my point.
No, Your Honor. So if you look at the judgments in the other cases for the restitution amounts, they don't list Ms. Eggleston as being joint and several in those judgments. So they're listed in her judgment as joint and several.
I see.
She's only responsible for that portion for which she contributed.
Okay.
If the court has no other questions related to restitution, I can move on to the sentencing enhancements. And what I would really like to do is clear up first the confusion on the standard of review here. So she actually didn't object to either of the sentencing guideline enhancements in her sentencing memo. She did mention in discussing the nature and circumstances of the offense as a 3553A factor, she mentioned that she didn't have a leadership role compared to the other two owners of the home healthcare agencies. but that's not the same as objecting to the application of the sentencing enhancement. And if you look at the first page of her sentencing memo, she says she sat down with her attorney. Her attorney writes that they sat down together and reviewed the sentencing enhancements in the PSR and that the enhancements are not in dispute. So that could be read as a waiver because it shows an intentional choice not to raise that issue. At the very least, it should be reviewed for plain error only. And in terms of the leader and organizer enhancement, that enhancement applies in a scheme with four or more people where a defendant exerted control, recruited other participants, had decision-making authority, and participated in the planning and organizing of this. And the evidence that supports that enhancement is her role in recruiting not just patients. She wasn't just a patient recruiter. She also recruited doctors into the scheme. Excuse me,
I missed what you said. Her role in doing what?
In recruiting other participants of the scheme. So she wasn't just recruiting patients. And a lot of the cases talk about whether this enhancement applies in terms of patient recruiters. But she was recruiting doctors to participate as well. They needed doctors to sign off on these prescriptions for home health care. So she was recruiting them, but also telling the doctors how to prescribe and what to prescribe. She told them to prescribe home health care. She told them to prescribe certain medications. She was basically bringing people in, having doctors do what she needed to do in order for her to receive kickbacks in the scheme and for the scheme to function. She also made several threats to some of the patients that were receiving home health care. And that's why the government believes the vulnerable victim enhancement applies. Those individuals who were sick and reliant on government services, some of them were threatened into receiving home health care that they didn't need. And it goes toward both her role in the scheme and their vulnerability. And there is case law saying that those two enhancements are not mutually exclusive. Does the court have any other questions for me regarding any of the issues? Thank you. We ask that you affirm the conviction and judgment.
Rebuttal?
Your Honors, I would like to address the issues of sentencing enhancement and particularly the standard. The government argues that it should be for plain error because Ms. Eggleston did not preserve the issue. However, in her sentencing memo, she does say that there was no evidence to apply the leadership enhancement. Also, she sufficiently articulated her objection and the basis of that objection in her sentencing memo, which this court in United States versus Bostick in 2004 held was sufficient to preserve the issue and should be. And so the question of whether the leadership enhancement should apply should be reviewed de novo. Also, the fact that she brought in doctors is still within the discretion of her role as a recruiter. She did recruit doctors as well as patients. However, this is different from whether she was a leader or whether she was exerting control over the direction of the scheme. And she, like, given the fact that she was such a non-critical part of this scheme, it's the fact that she brought in doctors isn't dispositive of her role as a leader.
Counsel, let me interrupt. I can't let the remark she was a non-critical part of this scheme go unresponded to. The two formulators of this scheme testified against her and testified she was the most important person they had. She was the linchpin of this thing going forward. So to say that there's no evidence that she was just casually along the way just isn't an accurate representation of the record.
Your Honor, when Ms. Eggleston entered the scheme, the testimonies reflect that the scheme was already ongoing. And not only was the scheme already ongoing, there were about 20 other patient recruiters fulfilling the exact same role as Ms. Eggleston. So even without Ms. Eggleston, the scheme could have and did proceed without Ms. Eggleston's participation. And so the scheme would have materialized with or without Ms. Eggleston. And so to say that her role was the linchpin, I think would be an inaccurate characterization of a leader, of whether she was a leader in the role. And as far as restitution issues go, the government raised that that she was given a less, she was not substantially harmed. Her substantial rights were not harmed. But we just wanted to push back on that. Her substantial rights were harmed because not only is she the prototypical defendant to have apportioned liability, given her economic standing and given the respective contribution to the victim's losses, there was no factual finding as to whether she actually contributed the amount that the district court found that she was contributed to. Sorry, I see that my time has expired.
Well, let me just pursue that point with you a minute, because clearly, joint and several liability could have been imposed. The alleged error, as I understand it, was that she was lumped with people in a different case. That's a different thing from saying the horror stories about what could happen in joint and several liability could have happened in a case in which nobody was joined but defendants in any one case, correct?
While that is true, I think if several different cases were ruling on the restitution, the overlapping restitution orders could get difficult to keep track. And it really is a matter of policy. It is way more easier to for district courts to follow a bright line rule rather than ordering overlapping restitution orders that could get too scrambled. So in that way, I think the policy reasoning is really why joint and several restitution should not be allowed.
Thank you all. The case will be submitted. And thank you for your work at the clinic.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you.